it is important for me while we're talking about permaculture. You heard Jack say and a few others pay tribute to the fact that permaculture really comes from indigenous methods of teaching. For example, here in Mexico, people have been doing swales forever before somebody came along and gave it a name, right? People have been doing these practices. And in fact, just a little bit of brief history, back in the 50s, it was the Rockefeller Foundation and this scientist who came down here to Mexico and told the indigenous farmers, you don't know what you're doing. Here's some pesticides and some GMO seeds. We'll teach you how to farm, right? So it's important that we recognize indigenous systems that have existed for thousands of years and the importance of that. So Dr. Lila June Johnston, she's an indigenous musician. Maybe she'll do a song for us. Author and community organizer of Diné, Cheyenne, and European lineages. Her multi-genre presentation style has engaged audiences across the world, including right here, towards personal, collective, and ecological healing. Lila has studied, her studies blend human ecology at Stanford, her graduate work in indigenous pedagogy, and the traditional worldview she grew up to inform her music, her perspectives, and solution. I'm going to reemphasize, maybe we'll get a song again. Her doctoral research focused on the ways in which pre-colonial indigenous nations shaped large regions of Turtle Island, aka the Americas, to produce abundant food systems for human and non-humans. Please give a warm welcome to Dr. Lila June Johnston, everyone.
Greetings, my relatives and my people. I am from the Nanisht Ejit Khachitni clan of the Diné Nation. We are also incorrectly known as Navajo, which is not our real name. That's one of those many colonial misnomers. I get this clan from my mother. In American culture, we get our last names from our fathers, but in Diné culture, we get our last names from our mothers. We are a matrilineal, matrifocal society. My second clan is my mother's, or rather my father's mother's clan, which is the Tsetsestis Bashishchi, which is Southern Cheyenne. She was from Anadarko, Oklahoma. Otto, my third clan is my mother's father's clan, which is Ashihe, the Salt clan of the Diné. Otto, Bilagan, Aedashanale. My fourth and final clan is the patrilineal one, my father's father, which is the European clans, as far as I know, Scottish, Scandinavian, maybe other stuff, I don't know. In this manner, I present myself as a Diné woman. So happy to be here. I've been enjoying all of the conversations. I study food systems, but the funny thing about being a PhD is sometimes the more you study, the less you know. Yeah, you go laser focused into a topic and then you neglect everything else. You become kind of myopic. But I've been enjoying the talks. My father's father is actually from Dallas, Texas. And I liked when Jack said, has anyone here ever tried to build a bin of earthworms and got eaten alive by fire ants? I was like, that is the most Texan thing I've heard in a long time. Because I am part Texan, you know, so I appreciate that. I love humans. They're so funny and some of the things they say. But I really appreciated your talk, Jack, if you're out there. And I think you kind of cued me up quite well, actually, by mentioning 1491, because that's what I'm about to talk about in a bit. We'll put up the slides. But before we do, you know, okay, let's do some music, you know? Let's do some music, because why not? All right. And let's learn how to beatbox, because why not? All right, so there's three elements of beatboxing. Number one is like a horse. Can you guys do that? One, two, three. Ooh, ice cold, ice cold. Okay, the next is like a tss, like a snake. And one, two, three. Tss. And then we got like a in the back of the throat. One, two, three. Okay, now let's put those together like a tss. Okay, one, two, three. Tss, and then like a tss. One, two, three. And then we'll put those two together. It'll be like a okay? 1, 2, 3. Okay. Now let's try like a. We were all given sacred duties to this land. Take care of Mother Earth and she will help you understand that everything we need is in the palm of her hands. No need to drill, mine, conquer, or extract. With faith in the Creator, we will blaze a brand new path. When we let go of fear, the greed turns into laughter. Unity of all people, that is what we're after. Cruising down the red road with sweet grass on my dashboard. I used to drug and drink, but now I'm sober, now I'm faster. Sharp as a tack, he told me, can't hold me back now. I just want to build a new world for my children. With love, prayer, and unity, this nation is rebuilding. Up from the ash of genocide and division. Red, black, yellow, white as one, that's the vision. Every race participates in this new beginning. Sacred is the masculine and sacred is the feminine. Infinite, indigenous, continuous, deliberate. Nothing can stop the people once they got their intention set. Some people say that the land can be owned. Some people say that the land can be owned. But deep in our hearts, we know that isn't so, because we don't even own this flesh or this bone. No, we can't take it with us on the spirit's journey home. The only thing we own is the lessons that we know. So when we wake from the slumber to remember we are one, one beautiful people under one beautiful sun, we must also release all claims to the earth, because she don't belong to us. We belong to her. Mother Earth was meant to be a place where we could learn. We pray to Khe Sapa for a blessing on the world. We practice Satyagraha because violence doesn't work. We pray for those who are injured and those who endure. I'm going to repeat that line. We pray for those who are injured and we pray for those who injure. Unconditional prayers for the whole wide world. We sun dance year round. Yeah, we let the sage burn, because when we pray for the people, we will start to understand what it means to be true woman, what it means to be true man. Cradled in the arms of the sky and the sand, just a strand in the tapestry of the master plan. Because together there is nothing that we cannot achieve. Together there is nothing that we cannot achieve. Can I hear you guys say that? Together there is nothing that we cannot achieve. Together there is nothing that we cannot achieve. Together there is nothing that we cannot achieve. Okay, let's put up the slides. Yeah, I'm excited to talk about this because for a lot of reasons, really. Partly to debunk the myth of the primitive Indian. For a long time, the world has called my people primitive. They've called us stupid. They've called us savage. They've called us simpletons, nomads, hunter-gatherers. This is all a colonial narrative designed to disempower, disenfranchise, distort who and what we are as indigenous peoples, to make people feel a little better about the fact that they wiped out 98% of us. And this hasn't just happened to my people on these continents, but it's happened to the Irish, it's happened to the Scottish. Sometimes if you look at what the English were saying about the Irish in the year 1200, it's like a carbon copy of what the Americans said about my people.
They're savages. They live in the forest. What's wrong with them? They don't even know how to plow a field.
And because of the way we tended the earth, because it wasn't the type of agriculture that the superpowers thought was civilized, we were deemed uncivilized. It happens to the hill tribes in Thailand that the Thai kingdom forcefully converts to Buddhism and forces them to speak Thai right now as we speak. They're deemed uncivilized because these hill tribes live in the forest. And it's very tragic that we have conflated living in the forest with being uncivilized, because that's actually one of the most civilized things you could do. And it has, unfortunately, not only destroyed entire civilizations, entire native nations that thrived in North and South America, but it's also robbed even the colonizer of this human heritage that could have helped them a lot too, could have helped them be more sustainable. It's robbed, it's impoverished all of us around the world to destroy these cultures because they hold so much that we could learn from. On that note, before I get started, I just wanted to say, as I go through these slides, you know, I hope that we don't focus on appropriating what I'm going to share, bottling it up, marketing it, because this knowledge is not meant to be marketed, it's not meant to be sold, it's not meant to be appropriated. It is meant to inspire, it is meant to inform. I do want the world to, in a sense, copy these things to some degree, but if we just take this native knowledge and apply it to our permaculture farm and fail to actually support native nations who are living like refugees today, then we're just taking their knowledge and not giving back. So I humbly ask that for every acre that you apply these ideas to, you fight to get 1 acre for a native nation who's been dispossessed, for a native nation who's been relocated, for a native nation who doesn't have access to their traditional homelands because it's been turned into an organic farm with great intentions, you know?
Thanks. Which today we see these massive archaeological remains of huge oyster middens. So we've been able to look at the age and the size of these oyster shell gardens, if you will, where indigenous peoples would harvest oysters from the Florida riverbanks, actually cultivate them, and these oyster farms, and deposit the shells in these massive piles. We know that in the Chesapeake Bay, indigenous peoples, which is where Washington, D.C. is currently, indigenous peoples ate and deposited shells for 3,500 years straight, oyster shells. So these oyster farms were what would you say, 1.7 times older than Jesus? And so they're incredibly ancient systems. And I'd like to go through a few of these case studies with all of you to show you just the beauty and the depth of these systems. And what I'm going to share resonates a lot with what people have already talked about quite a bit, which is that what's most important about a food system is not so much how big it is or what you're farming or how old it is or what have you, but it's the underlying ethics, the heart of the humans who drive that system. Are they doing it for others? Are they doing it with reverence? Are they doing it in reciprocity? Are they doing it with respect? Or are they doing it for profit? Are they doing it just for humans, you know, not for other animals or plants or living beings? Are they doing it not just for humans, but just for the CEO? Are they doing it in an extractive way, with the extractive goals These are the things that will decide whether a food system continues or collapses. It's not the techniques we use per se, although those are important, but the intention with which we leverage our techniques, the heart with which we carry as we farm, as we create. And so each of these systems is about 6,000 years old or older that I'm about to go through. By the way, is the projector thing like on my face, is that distracting? No? Okay. I couldn't tell. Sometimes you like presenters are talking in front of a projection screen and there's like all the words on their face, but that's not happening right now. No? Okay. I love that image because it really shows how massive these food systems were. And that artist's rendition is based on actual archaeological sites where we find in the Florida River banks just huge piles of oyster shells. And so in addition to that, after that slide, I get into the Shawnee forests, the chestnut groves. So in Kentucky, a lot of people say Kentucky, there's this dark and bloody ground theory, which I don't know why they call it that, but the theory is that there were no native people living in Kentucky. Only passers-by to hunt, you know, which is hilarious to me because it's like, yeah, native people lived everywhere else, but not in Kentucky. And of course, it's a colonial narrative to help colonial societies feel a little better about the fact that they murdered everyone in Kentucky or kicked them out. But Kentucky was actually a thriving food forest prior to colonization. How do we know this? Well, we have this really fascinating technique called paleoecology, which is super fun. A subsect of paleoecology is palynology, or the study of fossilized pollen. Yes, it's as cool as it sounds. But what they did is they went to Kentucky, took out some cores, some soil cores from the ponds, and they analyzed the pollen that's fallen onto the surface of the pond, sunk to the bottom, fossilized, telling an ancient story. And one of the cores that they pulled out was 10,000 years worth of records. The oldest part of the soil core is going to be at the bottom because that's the sediment that was deposited the longest ago. And what we find is, as you analyze the soil core and you look through it, different types of pollen frequencies, they call it, how much different types of trees and plants are in which layer, you can reconstruct the forest composition of this Kentucky area over the past 10,000 years. So what they found was that about 3,000 years ago, the whole forest was cedar and hemlock. And it had been that way for many thousands of years, cedar and hemlock. All of a sudden, 3,000 years ago, cedar pollen goes away. And we see an influx of chestnut pollen, black walnut pollen, hickory nut pollen, sumpweed, goosefoot, domesticated sunflower, plantain, dock, all of these food and medicinal plants. And what is so cool is that chestnut pollen comes out of nowhere and persists for 3,000 years until about 1830, when the American chestnut blight pretty much wiped out all the chestnuts in America, unfortunately. It's a whole other story. 3,000 years, the Shawnee ancestors, who we now today call the Shawnee, took care of an ancient food forest without ever collapsing. 3,000 years. What's interesting, too, is that we find in this area, in this time frame, rather, fossilized charcoal. 3,000 years worth of fossilized charcoal suddenly come into the soil record and stays there for 3,000 years. Now, this is significant because it means that these Shawnee ancestors managed this food forest with routine burning of the forest floor. So our brother Jack Spirko talked about biochar. I'm grateful he mentioned Terra Preta. I'm grateful he mentioned indigenous Amazonians, soil management techniques. But when you burn the forest floor routinely, there's a few things that happen. Number one, you're spacing out your trees, right? If you have a chestnut over here, and then way over here, maybe you have a hickory nut way over here, and then way over there, you have a black walnut, and the closest chestnut to this chestnut is quite far, which helps to reduce the spread of blight and fungus diseases. So spacing your trees is important because it protects them. Right now, you walk on a forest at the U.S. Forest Service, you have 200, 300 trees on an acre, right? Like, right next to each other. It almost becomes a pine monoculture. That's actually not healthy, later. When you space the trees out, you burn between. You're burning away any incoming shrubs or saplings that would compete with your selected trees and take away the limited nutrients, water, and sunlight of the forest. So you're actually burning around these old growth chestnuts, which cycles these dead plant tissues that have grown up in the summer. And in the fall, when you burn them, it transforms those plant tissues into nutrient-dense ash. So you're injecting ash into the entire forest every September. And indigenous peoples, they have lunar calendars often. And for the people in the Midwest and the Southeast, September and the Great Plains is often called the grass burning moon, because that's how important burning the grasses was. You start to develop, over thousands of years of burning every September, fire-resistant tree bark. You have pyroadapted species. And from this nutrient-dense ash, in the spring comes nutrient-dense grasses. And who loves nutrient-dense grasses but the deer, buffalo, and elk? So you have these massive food forests whereby you have your food trees and you have your protein walking around. And of course, it's not just protein. These are our sacred animal relatives who we believe offer themselves to us to help feed our families. So long as we feed their families with our burning and maintaining these meadows in between the trees. So when you burn, you're doing all of these things. And the Great Plains was also burned routinely. They mention records of diaries of explorers, I call them colonizers, but of Montana soil systems, where the topsoil, the A horizon, is 4 feet deep because of this constant, incessant, periodic prairie fires, right? There's an excellent book called Forgotten Fires that talks all about how indigenous peoples throughout what I call Turtle Island, what others call America, we're actually injecting this ash into the soil every year. And oftentimes they say, oh yeah, those poor Indians running around with bows and arrows chasing the buffalo. Actually, the buffalo were chasing us. They were chasing our fire because it was our fire that maintained grasslands. You go to places in Texas that used to be grasslands, tall grass prairie, are now overrun with thickets of shrubs and trees. Because when you don't burn and you let Mother Earth do her succession, you actually lose tall grass prairies, which is one of the most endangered ecosystems in what we now call America. So that was my opening slides, was the Shawnee chestnut forests. These chestnuts used to feed indigenous peoples from Maine down to Georgia and westward to, I don't know, I'm guessing at least Kentucky, probably further west. And so these chestnuts used to be our sacred relatives. The American chestnut is now almost completely extinct, unfortunately. It was wiped out by a blight in the 1800s. because Americans didn't know how to manage chestnuts. And then they called us the primitive ones. So that 3,500-year-old oyster, project in the Chesapeake Bay, where Algonquin ancestors harvested water-filtering oysters out of the bay for 3,500 years. And we can tell through allometric, aka, you know, sizing the oyster shells, that over these 3,500 years, the oysters not only persisted, but they got larger over time. And all of these explorers' diaries talk about, I have to cut this oyster in three pieces just to fit it in my mouth. This is how healthy and thriving this oyster farm was. Now there are less than 1% of the original oyster population in the Chesapeake Bay in less than 300 years of American management. So the Smithsonian published an article that said, ancient Native Americans may have the key to sustainable oyster management. And we said, yes, we've been saying that a very long time, but now the Smithsonian said it, so now it's true. It's okay, though. As long as someone says it and people understand it, it's okay. Okay, now the next slide I went into was a 6,000-year-old eel farm in Australia. Eels are a catadromous species, meaning they spawn in the ocean and they go up freshwater tributaries to hang out and mature. Opposite of the salmon, which are non-germless species. So eels come and go through the rivers to the sea all the time. And the Gunditjmara indigenous nation of Southeast Australia, they saw that over time. You know, when you're there for tens of thousands of years, you kind of notice some things. You're like, oh, these eels are coming. So they built this massive eel aquaculture farm, you could call it, whereby they would funnel the eels into little pools so they could actually have an eel harvest year-round. They would assist certain eels to go back to the ocean to spawn so that the cycle would continue. And they did not, they were not hunter-gatherers just spearing an eel hoping to, or whatever. They were actually, in a sense, cultivating this eel population, expanding it. And they did so with profound, and they continue to do so, actually, with profound love for these eels, whom they see as their relatives. The relatives of humans is sacred. And so UNESCO has recently turned this into a World Heritage Site, where they notice that the first agriculture in the world did not happen in the Fertile Crescent. Again, another colonial narrative, I think. But this 6,000-year-old eel farm, which was constructed using basalt stonework, creating a vast network of pools and creeks to manage the flow of these thousands of eels. Note that in order to make this system work, you're not simply managing a small riverbank. You're managing an entire ecosystem from the ocean, the reefs, everything, all the way up those rivers to the headwaters. So this is the difference between indigenous food systems, I have found, and the type of food systems that you and me grew up thinking about, which is that they are not small pieces of land where you fence off an area and you grow some food. These are bioregional systems. These are ecosystemic systems. These are systems that span not just 1 or 2 or 10 acres, but thousands of acres. And this is the scale upon which indigenous peoples manage soils, manage waters, managed fire cycles, and so on. And so I really like the Gunditjmara Nation. I really like the eel farm. I think it's very beautiful. The next slide that I go into is the Southeast cane systems. In the South, Georgia, Mississippi, Alabama, Florida, a little bit north of there too, you have this cane, which is just another word for bamboo. There's an indigenous American bamboo species that used to be incredibly important to Native peoples. This bamboo species was used to make everything. It was used to make our homes, our clothing, our adornments, our implements, our tools, our flutes, rafts, you name it. This cane was a highly important material, plant-based construction material, every type of thing, you know, we used it for everything. When I say we, I really mean those tribes over there, which I think are rock stars. I wish I was of those tribes. But anyways, this bamboo habitat has been reduced by about 98%, mostly replaced by cotton in the south. This bamboo species is part of their soil management strategy because, interestingly, these bamboo groves, which grow about 3 times higher than I am, if not more, and are very massive, these bamboo groves depend on disturbance. In other words, they depend on a flood, they depend on a fire, they depend on something knocking it down to keep going. And here's why. Because when you leave the canebrake, they call it canebrake, when you leave it alone, it grows and grows and grows and grows and chokes itself out. Because there's only so much sunlight and nutrients to grow around. And these things grow fast. So before you know it, they've sucked all the nutrients out of the ground, they've crowded each other out, nobody can get any photosynthesis because there's no sun, because it's so thick that they actually collapse in on themselves. So this massive ecosystem was completely dependent on human gardening all the time, one of which was through burning. Burning these cane breaks at the right time of year would tear down the cane in certain areas, bring that ash and those minerals and those nutrients into the soil, and actually cane is one of those species where if you burn it, it grows back faster and stronger. So it's kind of a cool metaphor too for indigenous peoples. It's like, y'all burn this down, we're coming back. Watch out. Coming back, we're multiplying. Slowly but surely. But in any case, it's interesting that the bamboo was reduced by 98%, which is the same percentage that native peoples were reduced by. So what happens to the land often happened to us, and vice versa. Because the land, the bamboo, needed us. They needed our constant burning. And who likes bamboo? It's not just the pandas in Asia. Buffalo. This used to be a major forage source for Southeast buffalo. When we think of buffalo, we think, oh, those were in South Dakota, Nebraska, a little bit of Texas, a little bit of Canada. Buffalo existed on this continent from Alaska down to Florida, as far east as Pennsylvania. Partly because we, as indigenous peoples, very intentionally expanded buffalo habitat by burning and creating forage for them. And there's bamboo cane breaks in the southeast were no exception to that. So the cane would feed the buffalo, the buffalo would feed the people, and the people's fire would feed the cane in this cyclic trifecta, if you will, of symbiotic relationship between soil, bamboo, people, and buffalo. I'm sure that's an oversimplification. I'm sure there's many different elements going on there, but I loved to realize that through my research and like, wow, this was such an incredible system. I also like to talk about the Amamutsun indigenous nation, who are indigenous to what we now call Santa Cruz, California, Hollister, Gilroy area. These folks don't own a single acre today, by the way. So if we could change that, it'd be great. The Amamutsun nation, I interviewed their chairman for my dissertation. I often say, like, the best part of my dissertation is the part I didn't write, because I interviewed 4 elders who just waxed philosophical for, you know, 30 pages each about how they manage the land. And his was one of them. And one of the things he said was, back in the day, our rule of thumb was 13 trees per acre. And we have these very sacred, very important oak trees, right? The oak was and still is so important to indigenous peoples. And there was many different species of oak for different purposes. And several of them were highly important staple, highly important food source, four indigenous peoples of what we now call California. These were not wild, I love what Jack said, these were not wild, natural oak groves. These were gardens. These were ancient heirlooms that indigenous peoples have passed down to their children for thousands of years, to the point where oak became a fire-resistant species, because people would burn around the oaks so often that only the fire-resistant ones would survive. And so it's fascinating to me how this elder, this chairman of the Amamotsa Nation said, when we burn around the oaks, we're smudging the oaks, we're blessing them. Because you're not just burning the saplings that would compete and take away limited sunlight nutrients, you're burning away the ticks, you're burning away the weevils, you're burning away the bugs that would otherwise infect your oak trees. And he said you get a much more robust acorn harvest at harvest time when you burn around these trees. And so fire for us has always been a sacred element. I'm sure it is for, you know, many of us in this room. And if it isn't, it's only because we weren't, didn't have the luxury of having those teachings growing up. But I think each of us understands fire is a sacred thing. Innately, we understand this. It's so precious. And so this fire was a ceremony for us. And we burned from California to Maryland. We burned this whole continent very intentionally, very methodically, very systematically, in order to cycle nutrients, in order to select certain species, in order to increase forage. The pyroadapted grasslands of Illinois, the Illinois Confederacy, we know through archaeological research, created an entire game preserve, you could call it, where you're burning these grasslands, you're creating grasslands that attract the animals that you eat. And yes, we ate animals, I'm sorry. We ate a lot of them, we still do. But you have to understand, sometimes you have a relationship with these animals. Sometimes you have a covenant, you have a compact, where they feed you and you feed them in reciprocity. And it's a positive relationship. And so, in this way, you don't have to cage animals. You simply build a home for them, and they come to you. So a lot of our land management and farming techniques were more about habitat expansion than anything else. Another example of that, and I'm almost going to wrap up here pretty soon, is the clam gardens. That just sounds cool, right? Clam gardens of the Pacific Northwest. So what you do is you create intertidal rock walls, which in Quadra Island, near the Vancouver area, we see that 35% of the coastline of this island has 6,000-year-old rock walls all around it. Why would you build an intertidal rock wall? Well, let me explain. As the tide comes up and then recedes, the rock wall will catch water and sediment and create a cooler, or rather a warmer, stiller water catchment system, which clams happen to enjoy. And so what you're doing is you're noticing what nature does. Like, okay, the clams like it right there. Let's create more spaces that have those conditions. Let's expand this habitat. Let's create a home for our clam relatives, whom these native nations afford their own nationhood to, clam nations, and interact with them on a nation-to-nation basis. This is how crazy we are. We see clams having their own sovereignty, their own nationhood, and we give them that respect. Because just because a clam is a clam doesn't mean it's not a person too. And so we create a home for these clams. And these clam gardens were very biodiverse. You'd have 7 different types of clams in a garden. And this was obviously very intentional, because we noticed that the more biodiverse a place was, is how Creator makes the world. And we wanted to match what Creator does. So we didn't do monoculture. If you look at these grasslands where we would burn frequently, very biodiverse. A study just came out that bringing buffalo to the land actually increases the biodiversity of those grasslands. When we would burn, it would awaken certain pyroadapted seeds. Does anyone here ever eat or drink echinacea when you're sick? Couple. That is a pyroadapted species. That species thrives after fire. Why? Because native people were always burning everything. I know that sounds scary to our Smokey the Bear and child self, but it's actually incredibly important that we bring fire back to the land. There's author Stephen Pine who writes a lot about anthropogenic fire, and I love this quote. He said something to the effect of, "The earth demands her tithe of fire, and if we do not give it to her, she will take it." In other words, we can either burn seasonally, or we can have catastrophic fires. You guys can choose which one you want. The fires in California are not just a product of climate crisis. They are also the product of hundreds of years of prohibition of indigenous fire, starting with the Spanish who came in. God bless them. They knew nothing about land management. Now these darn Indians are burning again. Make them stop. And they actually punished us. They penalized us. They incarcerated us for burning. This is how our burning practices were illegalized and prohibited before America was ever even a country.
So I'm obviously a bit of a pyromaniac. I like fire, done properly, of course. And it's so exciting, this tribal eco-restoration that's happening. And it wasn't until the California catastrophic fires that they finally started listening to Native people who've been shouting for hundreds of years, like, hey, we need to burn this, that they were like, okay, maybe Native people know what they're talking about. So now we have all these task forces in California, and they're consulting all the tribes, and the Kuruk are bringing their fire back, and there's all these films being made, thank God. But gentle fire, they call them low-intensity fires. Because if you have a catastrophic fire, that'll burn the ground. It'll heat it up too much, and you have what Jack called the hydrophobic soils that repel water. But if you burn gently, and if you burn often, then the fuel load never gets too high because you just burned last year. So this year's fire is not going to be that big. And you actually increase the water filtration rates of the soil. You create a spongy soil that soaks up the water. Because as you bring those ashes and that charcoal into the soil, you're creating little apartment complexes for microbes who love charcoal. A tablespoon of biochar has a football field's worth of surface area inside of it, because it's like a skeletal hollow cellular wall thing. And you stimulate microbial activity in the soil. And so fire can be extremely medicinal for the soil. So the dissertation I wrote, which should be out pretty soon, was broken into fire, water, earth, air. The fire chapter regarding the ways in which indigenous peoples would manage this entire continent with fire, and the ways that we could, again, hopefully in a gentle way, in a tribal consultation way where native peoples are leading that effort. The water chapter talks about indigenous fisheries, everything from the clam gardens to the oyster estuaries to the eel farms to the salmon. Talk about, oh, we all need to be not eating animals. Well, here's the thing, is that Pacific Northwest Native nations would eat about 300 pounds of salmon a year for thousands of years straight. If the compact was, if we promised to take care of their rivers for them, then we could have the honor of taking up their flesh. And so we speak for the salmon. Who's out there fighting for the salmon? It's Native nations taking down these dams. Sorry, I get a little emotional sometimes. And so that's what the water chapter is about. It's about the fisheries. The soil chapter, or rather the earth chapter, is obviously about soil. Talking about Terra Preta in the Amazon, talking about looking at the different ways Native nations would manage the nutritional content of soils, create living soils on regional scales. And the air chapter is actually about the air that we speak, that moves when we speak. It's the oral history of four Native elders and how they would manage the land. There's a policy chapter about how do we enact, what do we do? And maybe I should talk about that briefly. I know I'm at time. But I've given you all these ideas and you're probably like, okay, great, Lila, but what do we do? You know? And one of the things that I, with my limited knowledge, could think of to do is to create these cooperative eco sheds, these food sheds, where we don't have Joe doing this parcel over here and Jim doing this parcel and Jill doing that one, all using different techniques and fertilizers and what have you. But you break down the fences and you look at these bioregions and you say, okay, this is a huge watershed. How do we work together to take care of this watershed? How do we tap into these larger scale natural forces that are operating around us all the time? And if we simply dovetail them and work with them, what could we achieve? How much kinetic energy is the earth already doing for us that we can simply step into? Instead of hauling stuff and pushing dirt over here and doing all our human stuff like we know what the heck we're doing, just watch what she's doing and work with her. So that's one policy item I thought of. It's like cooperative food sheds. You all probably have a lot of good ideas too, so look forward to hearing about them. The second idea was... Land back. Has anyone heard that? Heard of that? So land back is this thing that has bubbled up over the past 5 years, which is give the land back to Native people. The regenerative farming movement is beautiful. Don't get me wrong. I'm into it. But how much of those funding dollars are going to non-Native farmers? Specifically Euro-American farmers, specifically male Euro-American farmers. 80% of U.S. farming land is owned by white men. 80%. And the Amamutsun Nation, who I talked about, whose space is 13 trees per acre, have this many acres. Because they can't afford to live in Santa Cruz anymore. They've been dispossessed. They can barely afford an apartment in Sacramento. So anyways... returning lands, as we open up these funding streams for regenerative agriculture, make sure a good chunk of that goes to Native people who have these visions, who have these ideas. I just started a 20-acre sheep farm for our endangered Diné sheep. It took me years to accomplish this because we don't have access to capital. I grew up in a wooden house with an outhouse, you know, in New Mexico. We don't have the type of generational wealth. We have generational dispossession. That's what we have. So how do we, as those of us in this room with quite a bit of power, leverage, networking, resources, how do we be in service to those communities who don't have that and who've been very systematically deprived of that? So that's another policy item, land back. Another one is to revitalize some of these systems. So please take this knowledge, apply it to your places, and at the very same time, work to every acre that you work on, try to get 1 acre for an indigenous farmer, for a black farmer, so that we not only heal the soil, but we heal history. That is the deepest form of regeneration, I think. So thank you all for your time. Have a beautiful day. I'm honored to be here. Thank you.
Let's make some noise for Lila June. I don't think we can let her out of here without one more song. How do you guys feel about that? John, I think we got time for the stream. Lila, seriously, it means a lot to me that you're here. I don't think this event would be complete without you and without this perspective that you shared. And I hope everybody here does really take that to heart. It is important. It matters. And as I said, we're in the land of the Purépecha people. And so learn more about the people here if you don't know, and about the hundreds and hundreds of tribes here across Mexico. Learn about the diversity. Learn about their cultures. You got time for a song? One more? You got one more in you?
Only because the live stream's not going. Oh, wait, no, it is. I was like, I'll just do one, a private performance. Hey, Texas. Okay. Okay, how long has it been on?
Just the last few minutes. We got it. We recorded the whole thing.
That's all good. It's just funny. Okay. Song. Yeah. Okay. Indigenous people, shine your light. We are equal. Yeah. I remember the days when our prayers were illegal. I remember the days when being Indian was lethal, yeah. We had a rough past, but get ready for the sequel. Get ready for the glorious comeback of our people, yeah. Rise up, all you warriors of love, all you answers through the prayers of our ancestors from above. I could feel it in my heart. Can you feel it in your blood? I could hear the seventh fire calling us to wake up. All nations rise. Rise up, cause now's your time. We don't have to hide anymore, cause now's our time. With forgiveness as my bow and my prayers as my arrows, pull it back and let go. I watch them fly like sparrows. Have hope, have hope. With compassion as my shield and faith down to our marrow, we will walk the pollen path even when it gets narrow. Yeah. Resurrect. Yes, you can bet that we seen the single mama raising children on the res. We seen domestic violence tear apart what we have left. We seen the alcohol take it all and leave us dead. We seen the children take their lives when they can't take the dread anymore. Can't take the dread anymore. No, we won't take the dread anymore. Cause we can't take the dread anymore. Yes, it's a war, but we seen it all before. And now we know we can change it, cause that's why we were born. We know we are the ones that we have been waiting for. Yes, we are the ones Grandma has been praying for. So rise up, all you warriors of love, all you answers to the prayers of our ancestors from above. I could feel it in my heart. Can you feel it in your blood? I could hear the seventh fire calling us to wake up. Pueblo hermoso, levántate, es nuestro tiempo. No tienes que esconderte más, porque ahorita es nuestro tiempo. This next verse is in Spanish to honor all the indigenous peoples who live in this side of this imaginary colonial border, which has divided a continent that was once very much connected. I just said today, no, don't let the colonial border or the language barrier fool you. We are all one people of indigenous peoples from Alaska to Patagonia and beyond. Mujer indígena, tú eres tan sagrada y traigas medicina de tu suelo todavía a pesar del abuso de tu cuerpo y tu tierra. Respetamos tus ancestros y la suya cultura, hombre indígena. Tú eres honorable. Yo veo la fuerza que todavía sobrevive a pesar del abuso de tu raza venerable. Yo respeto tus ritos, tus danzas, tus padres. Guerreros del amor y guerreros de la paz. Sí, no vamos a escondernos más. We are warriors of love. We are warriors of peace. And we will not hide ourselves anymore. All nations rise, rise up, cause now's your time. We don't have to hide anymore, cause now's our time. Yay. They say that history is written by the victors, but how could there be a victor if the war is not over? This time, bullets and arrows and cannonballs and weapons of physical might will not save us. In this battle, the only weapons we have and the only weapons we need are the weapons of truth and faith and compassion. So I'm very honored to fight this battle with all of you.
And I'm very honored to follow the Creator who knows so much more than we do. And if we just honor him, her, it, whatever it is, that force that creates all life, we'll be okay. So thank you all for your time. Have a good day.
Are you sick of being told you will own nothing and be happy?
Are you sick of being told how to live your life by the mainstream media?
Exactly what people think, and this is extremely dangerous to our democracy.
Are you exhausted with the truth community, focusing only on the problems?
Are you ready to do something about it?
Let's take action together. Join the Freedom Cell Network in January 2023 as we return with the Greater Reset for co-creation.
The Greater Reset is a five-day in-person and online gathering where solutions-focused speakers and organizations share practical steps for individual and collective liberation.
This year, we'll even hear experiences from real communities on the ground across multiple continents.
The Greater Reset 4 will focus on activating five focus areas over 5 days.
January 18th, liberate your mind, body, and soul.
January 19th, permaculture and food independence.
January 20th, agorism and parallel networks.
January 21st, take back our tech.
January 22nd, building free and conscious communities.
This is our time to co-create the world we want for 2030 and beyond.
Join us as we lay the foundation for the next stage of a free humanity.
Join us from January 18th to the 22nd, 2023, as we gather online, in person in Central Texas and Morelia, Mexico.
Join us for the Greater Reset 4, co-creation.
View the full speakers list and organize your local activation hub at thegreaterreset.org.